Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 107 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have two cases today, and the pickings continue to be limited, but thanks to Pat, we found two cases. They may, in fact, be the only two cases of the courts we cover that were actually argued this past week.
At least that were of a civil nature.
Right.
By civil, I mean as opposed to criminal.
That's right. First case today is from the Illinois Appellate Court, 4th District. It's Eckerdy versus Eastern Illinois Food Bank. And a second case today is a Title IX case, Doe versus University of Southern Indiana from the 7th Circuit involving Southern Indiana University. With that, let's turn to our first case today. Can a claim for retaliatory discharge for making a workers' compensation claim be made out under Illinois law where the plaintiff allegedly suffered a repetitive trauma injury but did not make a claim for more than a month after his termination? What is necessary to show that the defendant knew of the claim and thus had sufficient intent to discharge the plaintiff for that purpose? Those and others related to discovery sought by the plaintiff to respond to the defendant's motion for summary judgment will be addressed when the Illinois Appellate Court, 4th District, decides Eckerdy versus Eastern Illinois Food Bank. The plaintiff allegedly suffered injury to his ankle and back as a result of repeatedly getting on and off of a forklift. The plaintiff claimed he told his supervisor he was leaving work and went to the doctor for these conditions, but it was unclear he ever told his employer the injury was a result of his work. Ultimately, the plaintiff was terminated after he requested light duty and was off work for a period of time, but that he needed to be replaced because his job was essential to the business. The workers' comp claim continues to pend and is the third such claim that he made in his long prior employment with the defendant. Pat, tell us about oral argument in this case.
So a couple of things. I would imagine an institution like the Eastern Illinois Food Bank is a real tyrannical outfit that really likes to treat its employees very badly and retaliate against them. I can't think of too many businesses, a food bank, a business, air quotes here, too many businesses that would be less likely to engage in retaliation. Not to say that it's impossible, not to say that it didn't happen here. It's just that doesn't seem like the kind of business where that might happen. Especially when this is this guy's third complaint. Maybe it's they accumulated, they just got sick and tired of this guy getting hurt all the time. But let's just say this argument did not go well for counsel for the appellant. And I don't want to be too hard on him. We're going to play a small bit of this, and you can get a flavor of it. But some of this is succession-level cringeworthy from an advocate's perspective. So let me cue this up, and you can get a flavor of how this argument went.
To assert my retaliatory discharge case...
And in fact, he didn't do that until 6 weeks after he was released, correct?
I'm sorry, I missed your question, Your Honor.
He didn't even file a claim until 6 weeks after he was released, correct?
He asserted he was injured and asked for comp, but he did not file an application for a justified claim.
Apparently, my questions are not sufficiently articulate.
That wasn't the first time the judge said that during the argument.
On the stand. This is the point where you would have said, excuse me, but this calls for a yes or no answer. Did he file a claim at any point in time before 6 weeks after he was released?
Your Honor, I'm not trying to be evasive, but people assert...
It's either yes or no, then don't be evasive.
No, I disagree. It's not a yes or no answer.
Did he file a claim...
Counsel,
just a second. Did he... I'll do this as simply as I can. Did he file a workers' comp claim at any point in time before 6 weeks after he was released. There is an application of adjustment of claim that is not required to assert a claim for workers' comp. So I already answered, he did not file an application for adjustment of claim. That is correct. He talked to his attorney, and his attorney was not available to go ahead and meet with him.
So
now, asserting a claim of workers' compensation is very different. And the defendant has to do a Form 45.
All right, I'm done.
And they're required to report it.
Go ahead.
When the judge says, all right, I'm done, you know it's not going well.
You know it's not going well.
That's right. It's not when that begins to happen. A couple of things. We've heard, you know, I think it was Judge Easterbrook before said this to somebody when he got to a point where he wanted a yes or no answer. He says, I understand you have an explanation. I want you to answer my question as a yes or no. And then if it requires an explanation, please give it to me. That's the order. This lawyer tried to give the explanation first, then give the one word answer, the yes or no. Give the one word answer, yes or no. And if typically it's yes, that's true. He didn't do that. But then that's what the but's for. And then explain. That's the way to handle that, to answer the question and not get that response, which never goes well when the judge just, you could hear, I think you heard him throw up his pen. He got frustrated. He just was so aggravated and this had gone on for a while. This, they just didn't like his answers. They didn't like much of what he was saying. I don't know if the other thing was apparently there's some of this stuff isn't in the record.
Right.
So they really got a problem with that because they don't even know if it's true. It's just a lawyer saying things. That doesn't usually help. But so what, as Dan said, that this is a repetitive injury situation. And one of the answers that goes on after this is about how the plaintiff is alleging that, well, he's never seen a case where a defendant has agreed that a repetitive injury was ever admitted by a defendant or a respondent in a workers' compensation case. Well, that's great, but that doesn't really matter. And this gets to retaliatory discharge is, if we liken it to a criminal claim, is a intentional act type situation. In other words, the employer at least has to know that he's making such a claim. And counsel's right that he doesn't have to have the actual request filed with the compensation commission, but the employer's got to know that he's claiming that he was injured and that the injury was a work-related injury. One of the things that's very interesting is, does he have to actually prove that he has a compensable claim in order to have a retaliatory discharge? And I think counsel for the appellant is right. He doesn't have to prove that the claim is compensable, merely that he was making such a claim and was discharged because of it. I think that line got a bit blurred during the argument. We'll see what line is drawn there. This is not, as you might not realize, is not an uncommon cause of action, particularly in the workers' compensation context. And one of the arguments that the appellee made, amongst many others, but one of them was, is that counsel for the appellant was confusing various concepts of light duty under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and concepts of this interactive process that occurs under the ADA with complying with the workers' compensation, which the purpose of workers' comp is to get the worker back to work, get him some compensation, get him the medical care he needs, and then get him back to work. But that didn't happen here because his job was essential. I mean, it shouldn't come as a surprise that a forklift operator in the warehouse of a food bank is kind of essential to the tasks of that particular operation, loading and unloading food, getting it distributed on pallets with a forklift is probably as essential as it gets. And an effective and efficient forklift operator, if you've seen guys that actually, if you've ever been on a warehouse floor and seen someone operate one of those things, That takes some practice.
It does.
Not to run into things and drop the stuff and not get people hurt and all the rest of it. I mean, it's a to do it well and to do it efficiently is a real skill that has to be. You don't just show up one day and say you're going to do that. That's those guys really know what they're doing. And apparently this guy had been doing it for quite a while and apparently pretty well, except when he got hurt.
Right.
So there's some lessons to be learned in this case. The substance is obviously not something that Dan and I talk about very much, but there's also some discovery issues we didn't get into that seem to be not really discovery issues. So we'll see what the appellate court has to say on that. We'll discuss that when the decision comes down, which based on the tenor of the argument, we shouldn't have to wait too long. Dan, thoughts on this particular situation?
Yeah, a couple things. One is, as I mentioned in the introduction, that this is one of two or three claims in his long career, so we don't know what the other claims were about. And this,
he wasn't out of work for very long with those. It seemed it was like a week each or so.
And this reminds me when I was a paralegal at CNA when I was finishing up law school, we had a claim. We used to have a huge warehouse on Elston Avenue, I think, and a forklift operator, same thing, for boxes of documents for a big insurance company. And
this is the days before electronic
documents. He had a number of issues. He had, hearing issues, and so he would often not hear, or, the beeping and stuff, but it really didn't work for him. But he also had knee and elbow and all kinds of shoulder injuries, and so, as you said, it's essential that you're able to get up on the forklift and lift boxes off the shelves and put them on the pallet. And we try to reassign him to other duties because, try to accommodate him to keep his job. And he wrote a letter about how that was all the jobs that we were putting on were desk duty for ladies and very difficult guy. But very similar, I don't remember what happened, but he had filed a charge with the EEOC and Illinois Department of Human Rights. But these recurrent injuries are hard to, they're difficult to, like you said, prove, and it'll be interesting to see what the court does with this. But like you said, it didn't go well for the appellant, so I'm guessing we'll get a decision pretty quickly here based on, I give up.
Yeah, exactly. So with that, we'll take our first break, and we're only going to have two segments today. And come back and talk about Doe versus the University of Southern Indiana. We're back for segment two of episode 107 of the Podium and Panel podcast. And we're going to talk about a Title IX case, which seems appropriate considering this is the 50th anniversary of that legislation having passed and been signed into law. An expedited hearing on an appeal from a denial of preliminary injunction was heard by the Seventh Circuit this past week. And to Dan's point, they hadn't heard argument all since July 7th at all on anything. And it seemed like they brought this panel in to hear this because, as you'll hear, this is a request for or an appeal from a denial of preliminary injunction. The court last heard argument on July 7th. As I said, this is a standalone argument which emphasizes the urgency under the rule. The plaintiff filed suit against the school for suspending him for three semesters following an investigation that determined he had assaulted a female student. We won't get into some of the more graphic details that were addressed at the argument. Let's just suffice it to say the assault was sexual in nature. There was a controversy regarding the delay in reporting the inability of the female student because of intoxication to definitively describe what happened. The inconsistency in testimony between the male student and others who testified that he was in the female student's bed, and given the male student's lack of intoxication, his alleged failure to provide a detailed account of the events when the claim was of the school that he should have been able to do that. From a procedural perspective, the standard to be considered is of some interest. Counsel for the appellant argued that it was some likelihood of success on the merits. That seems incongruous. Yep. I've always thought that likelihood of success means more likely than not. You can't have some likelihood.
Anything's possible.
In addition, anything's possible, but I don't know what some likelihood sounds like. It's either 51% or not, it seems to me. In addition, there is an issue regarding whether they has an adequate remedy of law. Preliminary injunction is an equitable remedy. The appellee contended that money damages were available, whereas the appellant contended that the loss of three semesters of school, the potential loss of eligibility to participate in intercollegiate sports, he was a scholarship athlete, in the presence of the discipline on his permanent record, all made money damages inadequate. Dan, tell us about this oral argument.
Sure, and as you said, there's a lot of discussion about witnesses. There was a guy, I believe the name was Tom, that was the only person that could have given a full timeline, and for whatever reason did not.
No, that's John. That's the plaintiff himself. He's the only one that was at this party or this get together who was not intoxicated or not drunk. Not had anything to drink.
But and it's interesting because he's the one that's trying to seek the, you know, the remedy here, and there may be reasons why he's not the one given the full timeline, right? But in any event, there's
apparently a 14-minute gap here where. This during which this assault allegedly occurred.
And there's three items of what of the alleged conduct. The first was kissing. There was debate and discussion that she conceded that the kissing was voluntary, but there was back and forth on that between the advocates and some questions around that. And then there was groping, and then there was penetration, as you said. And we're not going to get into graphic details. John Doe said that by her being inconsistent on whether the kissing was consensual and the way that the investigation took place, that it became a credibility issue with Jane. So it's John Doe and Jane Doe in this case, because it's, we may have underage, who knows what's going on here, and to protect. Because
I don't think we're dealing with underage necessarily, but we're certainly dealing with sexual assault.
And it was interesting because you mentioned the loss of scholarship, the loss of three semesters. What the advocate and the attorney for the school, Southern Indiana University, said was that if he stayed at this school, that he'd pick up right where he left off at the end of the suspension, scholarship in full force. He'd be able to play sports.
There's a little entity called the NCAA that might have something to say about the number of years of eligibility he'll have left. And I was surprised the advocate for the appellant didn't bring that up, because his clock continues to run.
Right.
Even once he was a full-time student, it continues to run, even if he may get a redshirt year, but depending upon the sport he's in and the season he's played.
And the rules.
He could lose two seasons.
The rules generally are, I think you have 6 years to complete 4 years of your athletic competition. But like you said, Pat, with three semesters, I don't know what sport he played, that could have a serious impact on his ability to play. You know, some of the folks are in COVID. My friend's sons run track, for example. You know, they lost an indoor and outdoor season, maybe two indoor seasons and two outdoors. And so, you know, you could have stayed in school an extra year or stuff, but for most athletes, they're not going to do that.
They also gave them an extra year of eligibility. So you had some guys with 7 years.
The other, you know, issue with all that is, you know, again, if he transferred or something, but in any event, as you said, that some evidence seems to Judge Hamilton seemed to ask about that. You know, he said, you know, if you beat the motion for summary judgment or you motion to dismiss, are you saying that you have a substantially likelihood on the merits? And yeah, like you said, it's not necessarily to that point. There was discussion as well, and I'm not sure exactly the significance, but there was talk about the resources of the school and that Title IX investigations, because of the rules that came out in 2019 or 2020 in terms of the investigations that take place, that it's mostly outsourced and these people are independent contractors, but they do a lot of work for these schools.
They are top shelf experts.
Well,
that was the term that kept getting used. Top shelf
experts.
Although
in this case, the John Doe's advocate was saying that these were not top shelf experts, that they made 12 mistakes, that they just were not the top shelf that you would expect. At one point, there was discussion that since the new regulations, that most academic institutes were lightly resourced, like Southern Indiana University. And Justice St. Eve said you could say the same thing about the judiciary. And as you and I talked ahead of the show, Pat, Judge St. Eve should go over to the Cook County, Circuit Court of Cook County, if she thinks judicial resources at
exactly,
the federal level.
Yeah.
I get it. They are not very well staffed and things, but federal is a much different world than the world of.
Judge St. Eve, before she went on the appellate, before the circuit court, she was a district court judge for many years. A district court judge has at least a couple of career law clerks and then, you know, an army of externs and a deputy and a secretary. Go down a couple blocks to the Daly Center and see how much staff those judges have with multiples of the size,
right,
just in terms of numbers of the cases on the docket, and see what light resource looks like.
The other interesting phrase that the attorney for the college mentioned was the peppercorn situation. And I don't think I'd ever heard that before, and I'm not sure I quite get what the analogy is, but do you?
I heard it in a different context.
Yeah.
I've always heard it in the context of what is sufficient to be a sufficient consideration to support a contract. You know, a peppercorn is enough. It doesn't have to be very much. It has to be something in exchange. But I didn't understand what it is. Explain how he used this term peppercorn in this context.
Yeah, I don't really understand it. He just said that disputed issue of fact is troublesome. It becomes a peppercorn issue. That it kind of...
Yeah, it was like, if it was just a small difference, then that would somehow support that there was a likelihood of success on the merits. I'm like, what now? There better be more than that to be likelihood of success.
So, in any event, I don't know if you have anything else in this case, but an interesting Title IX. You know, the one thing I'll say about Title IX is that when we think about the 50th year of Title IX, the promotions and the ads we've seen really center around the equality in sports programs in terms of the number of programs that schools have and resources that go towards the various programs. It's much broader than that. It comes up in the student context like this. It comes up in the faculty context often in terms of Title IX charges. And it's kind of like the Sarbanes-Oxley for universities. It's imposed a lot of additional costs and expenses. I know my alma mater, you know, we have a Title IX administrator or coordinator on campus because a lot of things get fit into this Title IX other than just sports and the quality of sports programs.
Indeed. And especially imagine in some challenges at a school like your alma mater that has football. Football is, there is no female equivalent to that. And it just, there's no other male equivalent to that in terms of the cost and the numbers and all the rest of it. It throws the whole situation out of whack. It is such a large user of resources. We could argue that different questions whether those resources are well spent, but for Title IX purposes, they really throw the whole situation out of whack. So with that, let's talk about BI for COVID. Nothing really happened this week for the first time in a long time. Dealing with an issue of national import, not really anything.
The only thing that happened, and it really doesn't relate to business interruption coverage that we've talked about in this segment, is that some college students have sued for paying full tuition and being remote over the last, you know, 2 years or parts of it, and whether the same value, you know, was there. I mean, they got credits for their room and board if they stayed home, but the question is if you're doing things by Zoom, is it the same experience? And we'll see where those cases go. I mean,
there was a remand, a reversal and a remand on a case against Loyola University Chicago from the Seventh Circuit that came back on some of the claims are going to be allowed to stand. We'll see where that goes. That's not the last we've heard of that particular situation. Predictions sure to go wrong. There were no cases for the first time,
I think, ever
on this show, except maybe one of the early episodes, but where there wasn't a case decided. But there was one related to an issue we've discussed, and that's Starkey versus the Archdiocese of Indianapolis. And this was a case involving the ministerial exception. I posted about it today on LinkedIn. If you want to grab the decision, it'll be over there. And it's Starkey was a guidance counselor at a high school in Indianapolis, a Catholic high school in Indianapolis. And she was fired after it came to light that she was in a same-sex marriage. Her contract was not renewed. And she sued for discrimination under Title VII. What makes this interesting is that the court held that the ministerial exception applied to bar both her federal claims under Title VII as well as her state law claims under Indiana law. And in a concurrence, Judge Easterbrook, and he asked this question at oral argument as well, he's like, under the Title VII claim, we can look at an exception into the statute itself that specifically accepts religious institutions. We don't even have to reach the constitutional issue. The ministerial exception, as you recall, comes from the religion clauses of the First Amendment, both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. One could hardly argue that it isn't the doctrine of the Catholic Church that marriage is between one man and one woman. That would be really hard to say that wasn't a sincerely held belief of a Catholic institution. Whether she, the real issue here was whether she was, as a guidance counselor, a quote minister. Now, minister, of course, doesn't have to be minister under the Hosanna Tabor and Our Lady of Guadalupe cases. It simply has to be someone whose job it is to inculcate the faith in the next generation, which under her job description and the contracts that she signed, and she clearly was. So an interesting case to take a look at. Prediction sure to go wrong for this week, Dan. I think that they both will be affirmed. I think in Eckerty, the dismissal will be affirmed, or the summary judgment rather will be affirmed, and in the denial of the preliminary injunction in Doe will be affirmed.
That's right.
You down with that? Okay. So with that, Dan, why don't you tell us about the rule of the week? It's not really a rule, but a circumstance, and you dug this up, so tell us about this.
It deals with legal deserts. For those that don't know what that means, it's areas, especially in rural communities. There was an article in the Quad City Times, I think it was, that talked about the fact there's 66,000 lawyers that are registered and living in Illinois. So it sounds like there's a lot of lawyers for a population of 3 million or whatever is in the state. But there are
12 million.
Okay, so but you know, the thing that we used to see, you know, many years ago, and I've seen studies about this as well, is that, you know, 80% of the profession used to help individuals and things in the 1970s, and then it's we've gotten bigger and bigger firms that, you know, are more consolidated. And so what legal deserts are is areas where there's not a significant number of lawyers that are able to help individuals with their needs, like the cases we're talking about today, a lot of other cases. And it's a real problem because, you know, they in some very small rural communities, there might only be in one town, you know, one attorney or two attorneys. And so you get conflicted out, you can't really do things. And so what happens is that the studies and things suggest that it's a real problem for access to justice, and there's not a real good solutions. You know, in the medical field, there's Doctors Without Borders and all kinds of other programs. There's ones for rural communities to say that, hey, if you come out of medical school and you go to, you know, Quincy, Illinois, that after a period of time, all of your student loans are paid off and all your debt, and you get a decent salary. With law, we really don't have that. And so it's like you said, it's really not a rule, but it's a concern. You know, the American Bar Association, I think the Illinois State Bar Association, a lot of bar associations in various states are looking at this issue because if there's not enough lawyers to service, then it impacts everybody. It impacts the lawyer and the legal profession and the ability to earn their living. It impacts all litigants and all people that, you know, might not have their needs addressed. And I think in Illinois, the last time a study was done by the Chicago Bar Foundation and other groups, I think there were 3 million instances per year or something that don't get addressed. Could be landlord-tenant disputes, could be utility disputes, could be slip and falls, could be all kinds of stuff. And so, again, it's a concern for the profession. It's a concern for just the, you know, how we conduct ourselves.
Indeed. So we'll keep an eye on that. So with that, Dan, if you have nothing else, appreciate everybody joining us this week. We'll see you next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the podium and panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.